All right, so I want to start in, by the way, thank you. I think I've gotten all of the midterms. I'm going to go through them this afternoon. I will send a confirming note just to confirm that I've gotten them. If you sent me PDF or something I cannot edit, please just, whatever you sent me, send it again in a format I can edit, because that way I can insert comments and reactions, and it's easier for all of us, because you can't read my handwriting anyway. I can't read my handwriting, so it's only fair that you shouldn't have to. So the idea I want to introduce today is what Mark Miller describes as defensive correctness. And this is a slippery idea, okay? It's hard to capture because as we poke at it and test it and try to figure out what does it take to pull this off, we're gonna discover that things depend on other things, and that understanding what it really takes to build a defensively correct subsystem is gonna get us into looking at the dependency structure of software. But here's the idea. A server, by which I mean a process that's performing some service, it might or may not be shared, a server should continue to behave correctly, whatever that means. In the face of arbitrary client behavior or misbehavior. So, if a client has the authority to call a server, we're saying the client is permitted to make certain requests on that server, and that's okay. But we're also saying the server should not assume that the client is going to make those requests correctly, or that the client is going to make requests in a way that's designed to favor the server's continued existence. So we have to worry about what we might call malformed requests, right? So this is something where on the client, I've got a server, I'm actually trying, maybe I'm even trying to behave correctly, I simply send in a request that's wrong. The request number is off, some value is out of range, some string is too long, something like this. And there are two reasons I might do this. I mean, one is I might have a bug, but the other is I might actually be trying to penetrate the server. And if you look, Gary McGraw is fond of making a distinction between what he calls bugs and what he calls flaws, okay? And the distinction he's trying to capture is a bug is an error in the implementation. A flaw is an error in the design or the architecture. And Gary runs, he's a chief technical officer for a company called Cigital, which runs a very successful business doing secure systems and security analysis. And in his experience, what he says is, you know what? There's pretty much a 50-50 split in the world between bugs and flaws. The problem with flaws is they happen at a level that's actually much harder to understand what's going on. Right? They involve systemic effects. There's no particular line of code you can point to and say, ah, yes, here's the place where I got it wrong. And the next thing we know is that of the bugs, there have been several studies, and the numbers vary a little bit, but not much, okay, that say that if you were to beat buffer overrun attacks, you'd beat 85% of the security bugs. Now, I'm not sure that number is still true. And for buffer overrun attacks, you should read more broadly stack smashing attacks, heap smashing attacks, anything that relies on overrunning a buffer or an input call in such a way that later behavior of the program relies on the result. And Eric, you're shaking your head, but I'm sorry, this is the right metric. And it's still the right metric for software in the field. Hard to believe that the software could be that stupid. The culprit is C. People are still using gets.
So when you say buffer overrun, you mean violation memory bugs?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And there's a range of stuff on the other 15%, and I don't have any kind of a breakdown on that. Needless to say, the 13-year-olds are all going after the memory safety issues. So here's the observation. The good news is that in an object system, if I'm going to send you a memory safety attack, where am I going to send it to? Well, I'm going to have to send it to you as a message. And in contrast to the ways in which we build things like Apache, we tend to build the event loops in an object system, in a capability system, using an IDL compiler. So we tend to have actually said, right, here are the possible messages, here's what the argument should be to each of these messages, here's where I'm expecting something of variable length. And of course, a side effect of saying that is that we can generate code that will at least check for the memory safety attacks. We can even, at a little higher cost, generate a code that says, well, if I'm expecting something between 0 and 5, is it actually within the expected range? And it turns out that if you catch those, what you then have, so what you observe in programmers is, they say, once I've got the message in, I assume the message is good. Right? Most programmers will not write defensive code pervasively in their programs. Right? They assume that somebody did that fairly early when the message was received, and thereafter they assume that the message is good. Well, what we need to do is actually do that. This is not a universal solution to anything. It's actually a big pragmatic step forward. It's almost enough to survive the use of C. Although I still think that's a bad idea. So, an application could send me a malformed message. What else could it do? It could execute a denial of service attack. Now here, we have to divide ourselves into two categories, because there are some classes of services where the right answer is we don't care. Okay. So one possibility is that we're running a program that exclusively serves this particular client. We're a subprogram of this program. In which case, the client is doing denial of service on themselves. Who cares? The other possibility is that we have a shared service, something like a Windows system, right? And the mode of this is the client comes along and hits the Windows system with as many requests as it can generate, as fast as it can possibly generate. Now, this is going to turn out to be the place where thread migration is going to hurt us. Right? Remember, the story with thread migration was I was not going to check for preemption on the way through the IPC. That was the essential thing in thread migration. Right? The idea was the service is running on behalf of the client, and we should simply let the client's current quanta continue to execute while we're actually executing on the server on behalf of the client. Now, the good news about this is it runs down the client's clock. So if the client is out to attack us, right, this actually narrows the amount of time that the client has to do it. The bad news about it, of course, is that when that clock times out, right, we're now in this funny state that we're running on a schedule that we're not really authorized to run on. The server has its own schedule. And if the server runs at higher priority, then if I spend a lot of time calling the server, it's not just that I'm denying access to other parties, it's that I'm denying that access at high priority. So it's not just that I'm doing a lot of work, right? It's also that other parties aren't getting served because I'm exploiting the priority system. So this is one of the places where scheduling is the main defense and scheduling is important. The other defense here is polyinstantiation. And from the server perspective, if you were really worried about this, you'd say, oh, I notice that I'm getting about a billion requests a second in on this channel. Maybe I should just not serve them so fast. Okay. Problem with that is clients can always form new threads, so there's a limit to how effective that is. And even the decision, I've got a request, do I even want to serve it? That decision takes time, and that time is already being spent on the wrong party. In fact, the better move is to say, oh, I notice I'm getting billions of requests on this one channel. Maybe what I ought to do is flow control the channel so that no more requests can come in. Right? And I'll sample it periodically. But what I'll do is I'll take this channel and I'll just say, anything comes in this channel, park it. I don't want to hear it until I'm ready. I'm going to do some kind of scheduling, defensive scheduling of this sort. All of the other classes of attack that I can think of that might impact defensive correctness have to do with some form of durability. And as part of that, have to do with dependencies. Okay. So the idea of durability is, if I have access to a resource, how long is that access going to continue? And what is my contract about how long that access is going to continue? So if I'm a process A, and I form a subprocess B, right. Maybe I need some kind of a sorted collection, and this is going to be a copy of the sorted collection software. Right. Like you might use the DB library, or the DB library, right? And you'll create a copy of DB that's executing, in that case, it's a dynamic library, and you'll load it into your memory space, and your copy of Berkeley DB is separate from my copy of Berkeley DB, right? There's an exclusive relationship here. Okay. And so, if we ask, what's the durability of B, which might be the Berkeley DB subsystem, or a copy of the Berkeley DB subsystem? The answer is, well, how could it fail? It could crash. Its storage could go away, right? Somebody could reclaim the pages out of which it is operating. Well, how could that happen? In this case, what we have is a situation where that Berkeley DB subsystem is a subprogram of ours. And so, for purposes of understanding failure, this process A and this subprocess B, the subordinate process B, are actually in the same failure domain because they're built out of the same pool of storage. Okay, so there's a design pattern emerging. The design pattern is, sometimes what you want to do is control the damage, and sometimes what you want to do is say, okay, I may not be able to say exactly what that guy's contract is, but I might be able to say, that guy's contract is at least as long as mine, and once I'm gone, I may not care what his contract is anymore. This is like the tree falling in the forest, but nobody's paying attention, right? As long as the tree stays up while we're looking, it's okay. So in this case, the only way that B's storage can be taken away, well, B got its storage from A, so the only way that can happen is if A's storage got taken away. So it's not A's problem if B goes south because the storage goes away, because A is going to go with it. And the unit now where we're going to look for defensive correctness is at the client of A. But you start seeing dependency creeping in. Right? We depend on our storage. Now, in this scenario, I've just added a new process, which is this client process, which is calling A, which is in turn going to call B for something. And we want to know, from the client perspective, right, what's the contract? What reasonable dependency can the client engage in its interactions with A? In what ways can it depend on A? And so we might say, we might say, A commits that it will behave according to specification, provided it doesn't run out of storage. And certainly provided the storage it has is not taken away. Well, who could take that storage away? Well, if this subsystem, this AB subsystem, was created to serve this client, the answer is the client ultimately provided the storage out of which this subsystem is running. Okay, so let me draw that in, SB, the space bank, okay? And all that storage that A and B are using comes out of this space bank, and the client is holding a capability to the space bank, and it could go to the space bank and say, destroy yourself and all of your storage. And of course, if it did that, A and B would disappear. So A and B's contract is contingent on the continued existence of this storage. By the way, this pattern, in particular, where this service is operating on behalf of the client, this is a nice pattern. It's very easy to describe what's going on and what the dependencies are, because there's an exclusive relationship between the client and the service that it's using. This relationship will start to become uncomfortable if we put a second client in the picture. Because from the perspective of the client who provides the storage, there's lots of control. From the perspective of the client who does not provide the storage, the contract's a little trickier to state. The contract is, A will operate correctly provided that other client that I may not know much about does not reclaim the storage. And the key words there were, that I don't know much about. It's perfectly okay to say, I'll design a system in which there are clients that act in federation. Right. Maybe they collectively are parts of some larger subsystem, and it makes perfect sense to say, look, these are really one program that's been divided into a bunch of processes, and it's okay for one of these clients to rely on the other for certain behavioral properties. But if these clients serve different masters with different interests, then the next question we're going to have to ask is, okay, where should the space come from so that each of these parties is protected from the other? Right? And conversely, how do we design a protocol so that that space, which has to come from a neutral party, does not get overrun by either client? The pattern that we've tended to reach for in eras, and this has been, and this is yet another topic that's been emerging in this discussion on the L4 herd list, is we tend to avoid, if you look at the classic microkernel literature, right, the Mach stuff, the V stuff, all the early systems, what you see is a pattern, Minix, that it's assumed that the relationship is client-server, and server is a pretty big thing, right? It's like the file system is a server. And servers are intensively shared. In Eris, we've tried to avoid that pattern. And the reason we've tried to avoid that pattern is exactly this issue of making sure that lines of dependency are not confused and conflated. So the pattern that we tend to go for in Arrows wherever possible is to say, what it means to be a server, it means there's a body of code that you run that's important code that people want to rely on, but that doesn't mean we only have to run one copy of the code. So the pattern that you'll see in Arrows or eventually in Kyotos or possibly in other systems is that these servers get poly-instantiated. So you won't see one file server. You'll see hundreds of file servers, each one serving some particular bucket of files where all of those files have the same kinds of vulnerabilities. For example, they're the files in a CVS repository. And I might shoot the whole CVS repository, and hopefully I won't shoot the whole CVS repository, but the worst thing I could do is shoot half of the CVS repository, right? You'll never figure out what happened. And what you often find is that in these shared storage systems, right, the mere fact of sharing creates a very natural boundary to say, here's where I should draw the line for the dependency on storage. Now the other kind of issue, though, is that, going back to the picture, that if B is the Berkeley DB subsystem, or some variation of it, right, and A is some application using it, then of course A depends on B behaving correctly. So all these contracts, you end up with these patterns where you say, well, I will behave correctly provided everything I call behaves correctly. If that call structure is hierarchical, then that contract may fail, but it's at least sensibly structured and you can analyze it. If, however, you get into a situation where I have three processes, A, B, and C, each of which says, well, I will behave correctly if the next one behaves correctly. And you get around to C, and C says, now I will behave correctly if A behaves correctly. I don't know what that means. Or at least I don't know what that means without doing a lot of analysis of the programs. What we have here is a cyclic dependency, a statically cyclic dependency, right? If we simply look at the static picture, there's a cycle. And it may be that we'll look inside the code and see that there is no dynamic dependency, or at least that the dynamic dependency has a stopping point. I mean, recursion, in some sense, is a form of cyclic dependency, but if you go look at recursive algorithms, they all have a base case, right? So in some sense, dynamically, if I were willing to inline the code enough times for any given call, eventually the inlining would stop. We don't actually do it that way, right? But we do actually reason about it that way formally. So the observation is that things that have this kind of hierarchy structure are actually fairly straightforward to reason about, right? And things that have cyclic structure are very, very hard to reason about. And furthermore, that things like space in particular, so the problem with storage is that ultimately storage is coming from a global pool. There's only so much disk on the machine. Right, so the introduction of storage allocators that explicitly manage storage is actually a cross-cutting dependency. And so you end up having to say, well, if I'm going to say anything about the continued good behavior of my server A, I need to know who's got access to the storage allocator. One of the places where defensive correctness becomes really important is when you're trying to manage secrets. So maybe that I have an application that, even though it runs exclusively for me, part of this application's job is to keep a secret from you. For example, I have some client application. This client application is untrusted. And the example that I'm about to give is a contrived example, and I'm not proposing that this is a serious structure. And I have some encryption engine. And the client is using this encryption engine to encrypt things. And the encryption engine holds a key. And let me not get into public key cryptography. Let's say it's a symmetric key, right? Because you want this to be high performance encryption. And this thing is producing encrypted buffers using a key that is not disclosed to the client. Now, what does defensive consistency and defensive correctness mean here? Well, one thing it means is there should be no action by the client, barring a bug in the encryption engine. There should be no action by the client that should have the consequence that the key gets disclosed. Now, let's imagine that this encryption engine is exclusively held, right? Everybody who's going to use an encryption engine is going to use their own. They're going to make a separate copy. So what's going to have happened here is the client is going to have provided a space bank, and that space bank will have provided all of the storage that the encryption engine lives in. Scott, you're shaking your head now. Is that just to make sure your head is still functioning and your neck is still twisting? Plus, are you objecting to something, or are you just trying to stay awake? Or
I'm objecting to
who? Objecting?
I'm objecting to who has access to the space bank.
You're objecting to who has access to the space bank? Why?
Because the pages that the key could be in. The pages that the key could be in are accessible by the client.
Why are the pages that the key could be in accessible to the client? So the objection is, the client has access, the objection is, because people are on tape, the objection is that the client holds access to the space bank, and therefore, you believe, pages that are going to be used by the encryption engine to store its state, which includes the key, are therefore somehow accessible to the client. Is that what you're saying? Why do you believe that's the case?
It could be a trusted buffer object or something like that, right?
That's complicating a picture.
How does the encryption engine even know that its pages came from this particular space?
Good. Okay. So first problem from the perspective of the encryption agent is, right, is it really the space bank? I mean, if the client hands me some other process that obeys the interface of the space bank, it ponies up pages, gives me a page when it's asked to, right? That's not good enough. What I'm really asking when I ask, is it really a space bank? What I'm really asking is, do I know that this capability actually obeys the interface, the specification of the interface, not just the alleged surface interface, but the actual behavioral specification? Does it obey the behavioral specification on which I rely? And part of the behavioral specification of the space bank is, once it gives out a page, we'll never give that page out to anybody else. That's why it's safe to put the crypto key there. But I don't know that unless I know I'm really talking to a space bank. Let me, for a moment, wave my hands about how I know that I'm really talking to a space bank. It's an incredibly important issue, but I want to enumerate some other things first. So maybe come back to that if you would be so kind, because it's simple. But I want. So what can happen? Well, the client could send malformed messages, right? Got to detect it. The client could wipe out the space bank. Now what happens? Right, does this give the client access to the key? Contract with the space bank is that when you wipe it out, all of its storage is destroyed, which means zero. The key is now gone. The client did not get it. Now the bad news is the key is now gone, and we can no longer decrypt those files. And depending on whether you're the police investigator or the child pornographer, this is either a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your point of view. Okay. Could the client run content attacks in an attempt to discover the key? Well, yes, that's inherent in running an encryption protocol, right? Is that I can take a plain text that I know, and if the algorithm is vulnerable to this sort of attack, right, I can keep running plain text at it to discover what the key would be. Right? There are algorithms that have that flaw. We try to figure that out and get rid of those algorithms as fast as we can kill them, but not always fast enough. Good. So the hazard here, in some sense, is on the client and also on the consumers of those files who need continued access to the key, the crypto key. Good. I'm trying to remember if I have talked about constructors in this class. I'm having so many conversations with so many different parties, it's actually hard to keep track. So have I done constructors? Good. Okay, the key question here is how do I know it's a space bank? And this is going to lead us into a problem of authentication. And authentication invariably leads us into a problem of chains of trust. So, one of the design patterns that emerged in a system called Kikos is something that they call the factory, that the subsequent version of Eros calls a constructor. And here's the idea. A constructor instance knows how to create some particular program. For each kind of program, there is a constructor. And from the client perspective, protocol is to send a message, right, which is the make foo message. And this message contains a client supplied space bank and schedule. The state of foo will be acquired from this space bank. The schedule will be the schedule that foo will run under. And the constructor fabricates a new process. And issues what amounts to a start message on this new process. That's how the process gets running. And the process, which is now a new instance of foo, returns to the client, and that's the end of the process creation protocol. And you might think the right thing to do would be, well, the constructor would just reach down and fabricate the foo, and it would return a capability to the client. The reason this is not done is because that fabrication may not terminate, and we don't want to keep the constructor dangling. For example, we can run out of storage in the middle of that fabrication. So in fact, what the constructor does is a little sleazier than this. Initially, this new process, it's not a foo process. It runs an address space that's controlled by the constructor. It's the initialization address space. That address space goes and does all of the nasty bits of the initialization, and its last act is to basically carve off the top of the head of the process and actually swap the address space. There's an operation that says, swap my address space and program counter as a single operation. We've at various times referred to this as the auto lobotomy operation. Because it's sort of a brain swap. Now, well, what about this foo process? What's part of this foo process? Well, right, the foo process has has a capability to an address space, that's the one from which it runs. Where did it get that? Well, the answer is that the food constructor, right, holds a bag of capabilities. These capabilities are the initial capabilities that every new instance of foo will receive. One of them names the address space. They're put there at the time the foo constructor is fabricated, which is either done by a developer or it's done by the system install. Notice that these capabilities do not come from the client. So one of the categories of capability that it's very common to see in there is the capability to some other constructor. Now let me tell you the punchline about the constructor. So the constructor knows what all of the initial capabilities of its newly created process will be, because it holds them in this bag. And it's therefore in a position to inspect them. And it's therefore in a position to test them for what's called confinement. And the confinement check is really simple. It says, look, there are a couple of trivial system capabilities that are safe. A read-only page is safe. Any capability that is transitively read-only is safe. And if all those conditions are met, I will certify that the process that I create is initially confined. Confined means it cannot transmit information over any unauthorized channel. Right? And the protocol here is, if the client then hands the capability to speak to somebody else, well, that's an authorization. What we need to know is initially it has no outward channels. Right? What happens afterwards is not really our problem. Now, there's one more test. The constructor itself is part of the system trusted computing base. So it runs trusted code, and the job of this trusted code is in two parts. One is to inspect these untrusted capabilities, the ones in the bag. Right, and the other is to start new processes. So the third category is, if there's a capability in the bag that is a capability to a constructor, and if that constructor in turn says that the thing it creates is confined, that's okay. So what we end up with is this transitive recursive structure of successively confining subsystems. I will go back through this tomorrow. But here's the answer to the question about the space bank, or I'm leading up to the answer to the question about the space bank. So there's another capability that is allowed in here, and initially it was by special dispensation, and I do not remember whether we were able to get rid of the special dispensation. There is a space bank capability that is promiscuously available in the system. It's actually a capability of the prime space bank. All of its limit fields are set to zero. Okay, so you can't actually use it to allocate. Turns out, there is a mechanism by which one space bank can recognize another. So if I have a space bank that I know is good, even if it doesn't let me allocate something, I can turn to it with a second capability that may or may not be a space bank, and I can say to the space bank, this second capability, is it actually a real, honest-to-God space bank? And the rationale for why this special case is okay is the space bank is also system-wide trusted code. Now, this means that when we set up the constructor for the encryption engine, one of the things that we can put in there that constructor is this space bank validation capability. In fact, it turns out we don't have to. The reason we don't have to is it turns out the constructor can't call the space bank if it's not valid. And the constructor has to call the space bank in order to allocate the storage for the new child. Yes, okay, it's coming back. So this capability is not in the bag.
Right.
I put it in the bag at one point and realized I didn't have to. Okay. This capability is held by the constructor. Now here's why. The client's going to come along and hand us a space bank. The constructor is going to go to that space bank and allocate the parts of a new process. If that space bank never returns, the constructor is going to be wedged forever. This would be an example of a failure of defensive consistency. So the constructor holds this space bank validation capability. If you hand the constructor a space bank that isn't kosher, it just won't call. So by the time we get to the newly created process, the mere fact that the process exists and is running already assures us that the constructor has executed the check for us. And a consequence of that is that the encryption engine knows that it has exclusive access to its own storage, which was the condition we were trying to meet. So you can see that building up these protocols, right, fairly small steps, done at the right point, make a big difference in the ability to sustain a contract. And this kind of how you compose this stuff, right, this is why building this kind of system is incredibly tricky, and why for the most part it has failed in the past. Okay, so does that address your concern about the space bank? I want to do a second example because I want to illustrate something, and we just barely have enough time. So this is kind of a funny case because we've described this idea that the encryption engine is going to hold this key that somehow it got, you know, by unspecified means, right? Which is another way of saying by magic. What about similar kind of a pattern, right? So this time I have a client, and this client is talking to SSH agent. An SSH agent holds keys that it holds passphrases for, but the passphrases are encrypted, they're part of the key, and it prompts me before it agrees to use those keys to validate the passphrase. Well, I gotta tell you, when Internet Explorer asks me to type a password, I'm always nervous because I have no idea who's actually asking me to type that password. All I know is that I get a box, and if I type that, it puts little splats in the box. This is really encouraging. I don't know who those characters are going to. And SSH agent, if you configure it appropriately, will actually pop up a separate window that says, "Hi, I'm SSH agent. I'm trying to validate, the mumble key. Give me a password or a passphrase." How do you know what you're typing? You don't. You have no idea if that window originated with SSH agent or if it originated with some hostile piece of code. I can write Emacs Lisp code that will produce that window. I shouldn't say that, because actually I don't know if Emacs Lisp is clever enough to do that. But I mean, in principle, you can write scripting code that would build that window. So off on the side, there is a window system, and if you don't trust your window system, you're pretty much hosed. Your window system is your communication path to the rest of the system. If you don't trust that, you have to trust it in the same sense that you have to trust that your keyboard is not sniffing what you type, which is a big problem at the moment. need is a way for SSH agents to be able to communicate with the Windows system in such a way that the client application cannot simulate this behavior. And one thing that we could do is, and I'm not necessarily saying this is the right user interface, but I want to give the idea. We could say, look, we're going to reserve a chunk of the display down here at the bottom. And the job of this chunk of the display is to tell me what I'm really talking to. And how we're going to know what we're really talking to is a non-trivial problem. But the idea is that when I get the passphrase box up in front of me, two things are going to happen. The first is, because this dialog box is a trusted path dialog box, every password dialog box sort of needs to be that, we're going to do something visually obvious to indicate that something unusual is going on. The one that I personally favor is to dim out all of the other windows on the display. This is the subject of holy wars, and there are starting to be good studies about how to do this. I'm not sure if this specific proposal is the right idea. What is clear is that we need to do something distinctive so the user understands that they're being asked to do something sensitive. Okay. And the other thing that we're going to do is we're going to display down here that, yes, this window is really associated with the thing you call SSH agent. And the problem is, how are we going to know? Because we cannot trust SSH agent to tell us this. Because we don't know it's SSH agent. So what we need to do is, at the time that we install SSH agent, we need to say, look, the SSH agent constructor right, is going to hold this bag of capabilities on the side. And one of the capabilities that we need to put in there at the time SSH agent is installed, okay, is capability that allows any copy of SSH agent to create a trusted path session with the Windows system, having the property that all windows in that trusted path session will be labeled SSH agent. And how to label them is another big holy war. And just about the time you think you've got a story for how to do the visuals right and how to do the labeling right, somebody will point out to you that, by the way, the user is visually impaired. Okay, well, this is a really hard problem. And by the way, many of the proposed designs for how to do this flatly don't work. They are forgeable. Right? The problem is, I'm going to put up a bitmap here, and the reason I need this labeling area that's a protected area is the bitmap can be forged. It's just bits. Bits don't care who owns them. Now, notice that this session capability is not confined. It is an outward channel. It's very explicitly an outward channel. It's a means for SSH agent to communicate with the world, namely the user, that's not under the control of the client who instantiates this subsystem. And I'm going to have to come back tomorrow and tell you a story about why that's okay. But what I'm trying to get to here is how we're going to compose all of this stuff to the point where we can actually build applications whose behavior we can talk about sensibly. All right. I have run over, so I will start tomorrow and ask for questions.